You're listening to Dots, Lines, and Destinations, a travel podcast with hosts Stephen Seagraves, Fosma Moon, and Seth Miller.
Hello, and welcome to another episode of Dots, Lines, and Destinations. I'm Stephen Seagraves.
I'm Fosma Moon.
And we're joined today by Mr. Pizza Man, Ed Pizzarello.
Hey, guys.
Miles to Go podcast.
Welcome to Vegas.
We're sitting in the
club.
The club. In Terminal 3,
Concourse E.
And Ed and I had dinner last night. Foz got delayed today. We were going to record this again. We were going to do another car podcast.
We were.
Another car talk.
This doesn't have an episode number because we're just going to kind of talk about stuff and not, we don't know where it's going to fall in our schedule. So,
To be fair, if you did put a number on it, it still wouldn't be accurate.
It wouldn't be the right number.
Yeah, so,
in Ed's mind, because Ed's keeping
count.
Episode one. Well, it was May the 4th yesterday. May the 4th be with you.
That's true. Okay, so now you've time-stamped us.
Yeah.
Dang it.
Good job.
Got to keep it relevant. So we pumped.
That was a record. That was like 90 seconds. And he blew the timestamp.
Just a joke, Ted.
That's so great.
I came and saw the new Five Guys.
Yeah, we had, so Fozzie shows up. I told him about the breakfast sandwiches. We pull the breakfast sandwich up on the screen. It's the only location in the country where you can get a breakfast sandwich all day long. Okay. And his first words were just music to my ears. Wait, I can add a patty to this? So we had two eggs, two slices of cheese, four slices of bacon, and a hamburger patty. Because after all that, why not?
Well, of course.
Yeah.
My cholesterol pill got a nice workout today.
That's going to say.
Yeah.
It's a cool location. People should check it out. I think it's actually worth talking about.
It's in the Venetian?
It's out front of the Venetian, which is a problem for us because people have trouble finding it. So I don't know how well you know Vegas, but for folks that don't, Madame Tussauds Wax Museum is a building on the front of the Venetian. And we are the first floor underneath Madame Tussauds. So for folks that remember the Mirage, if you were standing in front of the volcano show and turned around, we're right across the street.
Nice.
Yeah.
It's actually super convenient, especially for people walking.
Walking traffic is great, yeah. Flamingo,
yeah.
Harrah's, all that. And when Hard Rock opens.
You'll have everybody coming across in this. Yeah. Because the shops are right there.
Yep.
It's like the Yeah. But I think that's why we wanted to talk to you today was, one, we like talking to you, Ed. But two, your thoughts on Vegas, your thoughts on opening a restaurant in Vegas. You're opening another one.
I know.
And how I want to know how you put up with Vegas so much. I get to the airport, I land, I'm ready to go home.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, so Steven and I were walking back from the restaurant to come see you. And I'm like, hey, we're going to go this way. And we didn't cut through the casino and we took a left-hand turn. He's like, holy cow, there's nobody here. This is great. So having been to Vegas however many bajillion times in the past 10 years, most of the things I do are built around avoiding most of the people. It's, you know, the casinos, even though very, very akin to one of your favorite places, Newark Airport, even though there are fewer people in Vegas, the casino keeps moving things into the walkways to make it harder to get through without buying stuff. Sound familiar?
Oh, yeah.
So it is hard to get from point A to point B without taking a lot of time. You know, when we were driving down the boulevard, Stephen, you saw the construction. They had a couple lanes closed down. Typically there's a lane closed down most times or doing some sort of paving. So it takes a long time to get from point A to point B. And, on top of that, you know, you have to be very judicious about where you buy stuff and where you eat because the pricing is, you know, there's plenty of value in Vegas, but you have to look for it
and work at it.
Yeah. Yeah, it's not like it used to be in that respect where every casino had something that was 99 cents or the buffets were affordable. I mean, most of the buffets are gone now.
Yeah.
I think we were talking about Din Tai Fung last night. So Aria, has a Din Tai Fung. It's fine. It's not as good as a lot of the other Din Tai Fungs I've eaten and obviously not as good as like a native noodle place. But it took over the only breakfast restaurant in Aria. They do not have a breakfast restaurant.
Wow.
Yeah.
Most even all they got before noon.
It's true. So in the morning, there's like one little cafe where they sell pastries and stuff, and there's usually 40 or 50 people online waiting for a pastry or Starbucks.
It's crazy.
Yeah.
Aria's connected to, what's the other one, Vidara?
Aria is connected to Vidara on one side and then Cosmo on the other. Yeah. So, I mean, it's You can walk to other places and get breakfast. But I think, you know, I think the thing about Vegas, at least, you know, for folks who have been coming here for a long time, was there's always a lane you could be in. And if you wanted to be in the rich people's lane, like, there's plenty of rich people stuff to do. But there's always a lane for normal people like us to be able to just come and hang at a pool and not spend a fortune. And
yeah. I feel so honored you called me normal.
Maybe I meant Steven. Yeah, there's two of us. I could say we, yeah. But I can remember more than once, so the only member of the trio of you who's not here, Seth, more than once looking on Instagram and seeing Seth's feet and like the tile of the Luxor pool in the background and going, hey, you're here? And yeah. then we'd have dinner.
Yeah.
And yeah, you know, he'd be here for a conference and his room was, you know, whatever, $40. And he could get, you know, go sit in a chair at the pool with an umbrella and cheap trip for a conference, here for a few days, spend a couple $100 and he's gone.
Oh, yeah.
That's harder to do. I mean, it's still doable, but
unless you end up at Circus.
You do, or, so I was having a conversation with somebody who works for Five Guys and he, you know, he was here and, you know, he's on a per diem and the whole bit and he's like, hey, I want to go out for steak tonight, but I saw how much the steak dinner that we went to last night was. And I told him to go to, there's a place called Tender at Luxor. It's, I mean, same quality steak as any of the other MGM properties and it's, you know, half the price. Cause it's Luxor.
But you have to like look for that.
Yeah. There's no, I mean, you're not going to walk through the airport and see a billboard for Tender because, you know, they can't afford it.
Yeah.
So there's pockets of value. We talked about Piro's, the Italian place that's over by the convention center. Old school Italian, the Rat Pack used to hang out there back in the day. So there's places you can get value. You mentioned the place, the Thai place that you go to that's off strip. There are two locations off strip.
Lotus of Siam.
Yeah. Oh, it was Lotus. Okay. I was going to ask you. We didn't mention the name last night because they moved one of their locations. Yeah,
they closed one and then they're moving it.
So, yeah.
You know, when I used to come to Vegas regularly, I would stay at the SLS to avoid the strip.
Steve and I were talking about SLS last night.
I missed the SLS.
I totally missed the SLS. And you could just stay on, is it Flamingo on the other side?
Mm-hmm.
Just stay on Flamingo, stay out off the strip.
Yep.
And it was, everything there was reasonably priced, even though it was a very nice hotel.
Yeah, it still is a nice hotel. Like, I mean, the rooms aren't quite as nice, but because it doesn't get the high occupancy level, the rooms have held up.
Right. And it's, I mean, I think the thing with the SLS, because it became the Sahara, it's back to being the Sahara. It was the Sahara, the Cayman SLS.
Yeah.
Back to being the Sahara. I think it's smaller rooms, I think, than when you look at, like, the Rio. The room I got at the Rio was massive.
They are really big rooms.
They're huge. But the SLS was fine. Like, it's what you needed. It was a bed. It was a nice bathroom.
Yeah.
It was good.
As far as Vegas is concerned, I feel like it's more boutique-y because it's not 40 stories, 50 stories.
Right.
It's a much smaller hotel.
Did it used to be the W?
There was
were next to each other.
There were two towers. One tower was a W and one tower was
the SLS.
Was the SLS tower, yeah. Yeah.
Is the W still there or is it gone too?
No, when SLS, so the guy who ran SLS.
W was that?
The W is what used to be the Delano.
Yeah, that's right.
So the behind the Mandalay Bay. So Mandalay Bay had, it was Delano. It was the hotel at one point was the name of it. And now it's a W. And that's a very nice property. I mean, the rooms are a little aged now, but they're in pretty good shape. That's actually the best place to stay if you're doing a concert or a football game because you can walk across the bridge to the stadium.
Oh, you're like right there.
Yeah. But I mean, like SLS back in the day, other than the fact it was a little bit off the beaten path, which for me worked because I didn't want to be on the strip.
Right.
It was relatively affordable. We loved it all because Starwood, you know, SPG points were, you know, it was a great way to get SPG points.
Always got an upgrade.
I was going to say, like, I frequently got upgraded there. Although, and thank God this is an audio-only podcast, so we don't just show visual aids. But I remember sending my wife some pictures because when you got upgraded in that hotel, that meant mirrors on the ceiling.
They also had like naughty pictures on the walls.
Oh yeah. Yeah. Oh yeah. 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 The suites were not G rated. No.
I do remember that thing.
Yeah. Yeah.
They showed someone a picture and they're like, what is that in the back? I'm like, don't look at that. That's not what you think.
Yeah. I stayed a couple rooms there. It was like, wow, this is very edgy. So yeah.
So what are your thoughts on Vegas charging for parking everywhere now?
I mean, I think they're shooting themselves in the foot with it. You know, I think it's so like part of what made, I think Vegas cohesive was the fact that it didn't cost much to drift from one casino to the other. And so if you're at Aria, it's easy to get to Cosmo or it's easy to get to Vidara. It's not even hard to get to, say, Park MGM. If you want to go somewhere else, you're either getting in a car or you're using a Lyft or an Uber. Almost all the quote-unquote rideshare lots are in inconvenient locations. And so you're adding time and friction there. And if you go park yourself, you're paying.
Yep.
And in the areas where they've now taken it a step further, in certain areas where parking was free, or included with elite status, let's say. So I've used Resorts World as an example. I love Resorts World. They take great care of me, quiet hotel, but they wanted to save some money. So they signed a partnership with Metropolis for their parking lot. I don't know if you guys have used the Metropolis parking lot yet. There are no people. It's all cameras. And so you scan in with your license plate, you put your license plate in the app, and then you link, in this case, you would link your elite status with Resorts World and would say, oh, Ed gets free parking because he's whatever status with Resorts World. And then you go to the exit, and if the camera can't read your license plate correctly, the gate won't open. And so like typically in the morning, I'll be on a call and I get to the gate and it doesn't open. I'm like, I'm sorry, I have to hang up because I have to call a call center in Indonesia. And I have to wait on hold, and then I have to convince the person that I'm legitimate. And then finally, you know, 6 or 7 minutes later, the gate opens. And so then people are like, well, I don't want to park. So they had a lot of friction there. And I think you saw it when we just left Venetian. It was $20 or $25 to park for what? An hour?
Hour.
Yeah.
But then we went to last night.
To Win.
To the Win. I come out. I'd gotten a ticket, scanned the ticket. It's like, it just opens the gate.
That was his own personal slot machine. That was it. He won.
I didn't know why, or when didn't show the card anywhere.
What he told me was, he said it was because he was a nice guy.
That is not what I said.
He said something like that.
Someone believed that?
I'm not saying somebody believed it. I'm saying he said it.
Are you saying I'm not a nice guy?
Well,
sometimes.
He's our host. You better be nice to him.
I don't host anything. What do you think? So, I mean, to Foz's question there, what is it that's causing... What do you think it is that's the linchpin for Vegas right now in getting people here? And what's been your experience with opening a restaurant here?
So getting people to Vegas right now is troublesome because, you know, there's a reputation that things are more expensive. I would say, so we talked about a little bit in the car that there are a number of hotels right now that are doing all-inclusive packages. There's also, when things sort of went sideways with Canada, the guy who owns Circa down on Fremont Street, Derek Stevens, he rolled out a promo that said your Canadian dollar is worth a US dollar here. So effectively giving them par for their currency. And I think it was like 25 or 30% difference at that time. Those are all good things. But as you guys know, most people don't book a trip to Vegas for next weekend.
Yeah.
They're planning it. And so doing all these things is sort of encouraging people to come back. But it takes time, and because if you have a trip planned and you think Vegas is too expensive, and let's use just Canada's easy example, plenty of other Sunbird destinations that they fly from Calgary, Vancouver, Toronto, Montreal, you go, well, I'll just go to Cancun or the Bahamas and I'll buy a package. And once it's booked, the package is probably non-refundable. So now if somebody sends you a package for Vegas, a promo, and say, oh, free, you know, all you're like, oh shoot, I already paid for my vacation. I'll get you next year.
Yeah. Do you think the current landscape, like when I lived in California, right, it was not uncommon for you to hop in a car on Friday?
I agree. You've seen the price of gas in California, right?
Correct. Well, the gas, but like then also parking at 40, mm-hmm. 50 bucks a night.
Right. All that adds up. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And I think they're just, and that was the thing, right? When the first time I came to Vegas, it was the Tropicana, $19 a night.
Right. Right.
Right. And it's just like, I'd never been to Vegas. Sure. I'll hop in the car, go.
Yeah.
But that was one of the allures of Vegas, because why else do you want to go to the freaking desert?
Yeah, and I mean, look, it's a much greater food city than it used to be. There was a time when it was more geared toward activities because you had, you know, like the aquarium and the lions and this, that. And it's a little bit less of that nowadays. There's obviously still a ton of great shows, you know, a bunch of Cirque du Soleil shows in town.
But those are kind of so expensive too, right? It used to be you could go see a show for 20, 30 bucks too.
Right. Yeah, last minute tickets are close to 100 bucks a ticket now. You know, sporting events are a reasonable expense here. The teams are popular, don't get me wrong, but the stadiums are also big. And so you can usually find cheaper sports tickets. They're building a smaller baseball stadium in an effort to sort of control that, but I would imagine they're going to be affordable baseball tickets. And there's other stuff. You know, a lot of concerts. So you usually find something, you know, obviously not the Sphere. The Sphere prices are exorbitant. They've driven hotel rates up down there as well. But to your point about the way a Vegas trip used to be, yeah, it was get you here cheaply. And Steven said this in the car, get you here cheaply, and then we'll find out how to get money from you in all these other ways. That was the sort of like the Vegas credo. And they got away from that. And that's to your point of like charging for parking or all those other things. That's the friction. If it was just easy to, because it's not just Southern California, you know, it's 3 hours from Phoenix.
Right.
And there's plenty of people in Phoenix that have enough money to come up and play the slots. What's ended up happening in Vegas, which is interesting because this gets to your point of like, well, why are you coming to the desert specifically? Red Rock Casino, Durango, and the M Resort are all three very nice casinos with very nice hotel rooms that are not, well, not only not on the strip, but they're a 15 to 20 minute drive from the strip. And so people will come into town and they'll stay at the M as an example, because it's right out on the highway going to LA. It's from where we sit right now at the airport. It's a solid 15 minute drive from here, maybe 20. And it's, you know, it's, they just built a brand new tower. Very nice. Our buddy Michael Traeger had Zorkfest this past year. The rooms are, the new tower rooms are very nice. But you're not really in Vegas at that point. You're at a casino and it's in a desert, but it could be a Indian reservation in Arizona.
Right.
Yeah.
Is it cheaper out there?
Oh gosh. Yeah. So here's a good example.
Is it old Vegas prices?
To some degree. So, so we were talking about the how busy it was with two big activities in Vegas overlapping right now. And I'll try not to timestamp again, which those activities are. You're welcome. But where rates on the strip are $800 to $1,000 a night, the rates at the M Resort for those same nights are $89 a night.
Mm. And with parking, if you paid every day to park on the strip for the conference.
Right. And the food out of them isn't necessarily great. The food at Red Rock and Durango, they have some higher end dining.
I've been to Red Rock, but the food there is good.
Yeah. Yeah. And they have they do
happy hour specials. So if you go in early, like you can spend $20-$30 for two of you.
Yeah.
And be fed.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And now their ADR has crept up, average daily rate. Their ADR has crept up. I mean, you're like the people that are coming in to do staycations who are in the West, even if they're flying on like a, used to be a cheap Spirit flight. You know, those are, you know, they're still $200 rooms, but they're not $500 rooms. But they're probably paying, there's one of two things. They're either paying around $200 a night, or they're paying, net, they're probably paying in the low 100s because they're probably paying a 175 to 200 night room and they're getting some sort of food credit. They're probably getting a slot credit.
They're also not walking a mile to their room.
100%. 100%. And they're like, let's take Red Rock. It has a movie theater. I think there's a bowling alley. And then they've got a handful of restaurants. They've got nice pools, stuff like that. So there's, you know, people come and they don't leave. They might go down to the strip for a show.
Yeah.
But then they're spending the rest of their time at Red Rock. So there's still a ton of convention business on the strip, but that's obviously cyclical. And so you'll see times where, and I'll use Resorts World as an example because where I stay most frequently so I can see the rates. I would say for all the rooms that Traeger has booked for me this year, two or three times my rate has been above $250 a night, and the majority of the rest of the rates have been plus or minus $100 a night. And you guys know what the Rio rate is, that's where you guys are staying. That's a $40 to $70 a night room. Resorts World is on the strip. It's not the most desirable location, but it's $100 a night. That if it's $125 a night at Resorts World, it's $300 a night or greater at Venetia.
Wow.
And Venetia's a nice hotel, but is it three times better than Resorts World?
So here's a question. It's theoretical, and maybe you don't know the answer, but if they went back to doing the cheap rooms, if Venetian cut its price by half a year, could they make money?
I'm going to answer your question with a question.
Mm.
If you increase the quality of the catering and amenities on board a plane, could you charge more for airline tickets over time?
No.
Maybe you could.
I think you could.
You're never going to find out because everybody who is in charge is paid to manage the quarterly earnings.
Yeah.
So this is the part, like, they're not
managing to their own thing.
Yes. They're not paid to, like, no more airline executive is paid to get somebody to pay more 3 years from now than the CEO of MGM is to get somebody to come to the hotel 3 years from now.
But in that same vein, right? With when there's no conference in town, even when there's some conferences, these hotels aren't at 100%.
No.
Right. So it's the age old spoilage discussion on airplanes, right? Once the seat goes out emptied, you're not making money on.
Right.
Once a room is empty for the night, you're not going to make any money.
Yeah. And I think so, like, Vegas has to relearn some things. And that, so I met a gentleman. I'll anonymize him a little bit because he may not want me to share some of the information that he shared with me, but he knows a lot about Vegas. And it, like, one of the things that he shared with me were Treasure Island occupancy rates. TI was traditionally a hotel that did a lot of package business, and it did a lot of Canadian package business. And their occupancy rates are very low, especially compared to the Venetian, which is across the street. So to your point about you know, a place in, you know, a place in time. I remember, Bill Merritt used to say, we sell a time and a place and we can't sell it twice tomorrow. That's not the exact quote, but, so for a hotel like Treasure Island, they've got their own show. They've got, you know, a handful of restaurants. They've got their gambling. To your point, if that room goes empty, all of those other assets get zero off that bed. And so when conferences drop to zero or much lower, I really think they should be more heavily discounting and or activating something. So like at least with Venetian and Palazzo right now, they have the Sphere. And so what they've done is they've said, all right, on times where we don't have big conventions, we've got U2 or No Doubt or Backstreet Boys. And that fills beds.
Yeah.
But that doesn't fill beds at Caesars.
Right. But like, you know, if Caesars and all these hotels started dropping down the rates to get people in the door,
mm-hmm.
it's the ancillary discussion. Once they're a captive audience, people will spend money.
I agree. I think if you made an appeal, you got your database of loyal customers and you said, I'm going to go out to every zip code in Southern California and I'm going to give you an offer for the summertime and not just the all inclusive, but highlight some of the things. Free parking. Put a 6-pack of bottled water in their room. Put a 6-pack of Budweiser in their room. It's dirt cheap compared to what you pay for it. To your point, a certain number of people would drive because they're just like with Spirit, for the person who lives in Southern California, the competition for a weekend in Vegas is probably sitting in their backyard. Like they're not choosing between let me go to Vegas or I'm going to fly to Cancun.
It's either Palm Springs or Vegas.
But they're not likely to be getting on a plane going somewhere else. And so if you give them an incentive, they may come. And if they don't come, all you really lost was the flyer.
Yeah. I feel that what Vegas has done is they've pivoted from guaranteed revenue up front versus what they might make.
Yes.
If they're here.
Yeah.
And they wanted more certainty and a little less uncertainty. But I think it's biting them in the ass now.
Yeah. And I don't know that. So I remember, I think it was pre-COVID when they pivoted and it finally became, they were making more 51, the metaphorical 51% was coming from non-gaming revenue sources in Vegas. And it was all celebrated. It was like, oh, we've turned this corner. But to your point that when that customer doesn't come, you now lose revenue in a number of different places.
Yeah.
And you could at least attract locals back then to come in and play slots or blackjack or stuff like that. But locals don't come to the Strip. They really don't. There are enough places for them to gamble if gambling is their thing. Or they can go to Fremont Street. Yeah. Fremont Street does a brisk staycation business for locals. So Plaza is a great example of it. Plaza has a great staycation business with locals.
What do you think the impact is going to be long-term from Spirit?
Oh, it did be. I think Spirit was the quintessential Vegas airline.
Yep.
What Southwest used to be.
Well, I would say it's probably Spirit and Allegiant.
Yes, but Allegiant is much more constrained in city pairs. Mm-hmm. Like, you know, what Allegiant has done best is stay disciplined. They said, we're going to fly planes where we know we can fill them. We're going to fly them on days we know we can fill the plane. And the Allegiant planes that come to Vegas are packed. Could they increase capacity? They could. There obviously are used planes out there. And I think that would.
A lot more now.
Yeah, exactly. So I think that would be that's certainly a strategy that I would consider for folks. And I think you could. If you did it the right way, I'm sure you could work with the casinos on partnerships to make it worth their while to sell in packages, which the business of Allegiant has done very well with.
Right.
Now, some of the other airlines, like Southwest, is not traditionally a package airline, more of like a Frontier thing, Spirit, Allegiant. So maybe it's not necessarily a path that a Southwest could take. I don't know if a Breeze or a Velo has the plumbing to do packages. JetBlue does, right?
I think Southwest could.
They could, but I don't know if they have the...
Southwest used to.
They've gotten away from it, though.
But all the majors did, right?
And to some degree, but I mean, you know, but yeah, the majors, yes. But Allegiant does it well. I think JetBlue does it reasonably okay. Maybe not Vegas sort of packages, but like rental cars. Like they have the plumbing to put something together. So I think, you know, I think that if you're going to generate revenue in Vegas, I think package revenue is where I'd start, as opposed to trying to attract folks at the higher end right now. Because the folks at the higher end can fly other places.
There's also a lot fewer of them.
For sure. But to your point, people who are on the lower income spectrum who live in a city where there might be a cheap flight, you're battling against the couch. If you make it couple hundred bucks for them to come for a weekend.
It's an easier choice.
It's yeah, right. Where if you have a little bit of money, you probably already have your travel booked.
I was gonna say you mentioned something, which was something I was talking to Steven about the last few days. Friction.
Yeah.
And the amount of friction that has crept up in travel.
Yeah.
And it just drives me crazy. Like today, I was in San Diego, went to check into the Chase Lounge. Like it's a 35 to 40 minute wait.
Yeah.
I'm like, then why am I paying for this card? And I got to a discussion with the supervisor and I quote, "We encourage people to show up to the airport 3 hours early so they can enjoy the lounge."
And on the flip side of the friction side, have you guys seen the rules for the sidecar lounge? Sidecar lounge.
It's within an hour, right?
90 minutes.
90 minutes. Okay.
But you cannot get on the list ahead of time.
You show up and you get in or you wait.
So if you're there 2 hours ahead of time, you have to wait 30 minutes and then you get on the list. So if at that point the list is already long, it's not like you can say at 2 hours, okay, I'm here early, can you put me on the list? And when it gets to minute 89, then I get in. No, at minute 89, now you're on whatever the wait is at that moment. And that's
when did the airline lounges become club, like nightclubs?
Well, the airline lounges are the haven right now because you can get in.
Right.
Unless you're on a
deal. Well, I mean, like airport lounges. Like,
yeah.
I think it's this premium credit card push, right? All the blogging community has pushed them so aggressively that everybody needs to feel like they're exclusive and go hang out in the lounge. And at this point, I feel like the exclusive place to be is in the terminal.
Well, in fairness, it's not just the blogging community. The banking reps get paid an incredible sum to sell premium cards to people with money market accounts. I have some colleagues that work for some of the banks, and the money that's being paid to get anybody who's got a money market account, it's like, hey, they're getting the same commission the blogger. Everybody's pushing these things, and we know how constrained the capacity is. Take the sidecar as an example. There's like 30 seats.
Where is that?
So in D here in Vegas, yeah, McCarran. So in terminal, so when you come up in the rotunda, what used to be one of the old priority pass lounges, they turned into this sidecar lounge. So it's different access restrictions than the main Centurion lounge. It's this 90-minute thing. Food was very good, but there's 13 or 14 seats at the bar. There's a couple of single tables, like the same size tables that we're recording at here, just like a small cocktail size table with one chair in a row facing a window. And there's two larger communal tables that seat like four or five. That's the entire seating.
And do they have a Centurion launcher as well?
They do. And it's generally speaking at capacity, but there you can get on the wait list ahead of time.
It's crazy.
It's like, why is anyone paying for these cards?
Yeah. Well, and then on top of that, we talk about friction. I hadn't run into this one yet, but it's an interesting one. I had a ticket on United. It was during one of the irregular ops situations. I did not have a seat. Since Capital One Lounge would not let me in because I did not have a seat assignment. They created the rule because they don't want people who are flying standby to crowd the lounge. I'm like, I'm not flying standby. I have a confirmed ticket. And they're like, sorry, without a seat assignment, you cannot come into the lounge. I had to go get a United agent from a different flight to assign me a seat so I could come back in and go into the center, into the Cap One lounge. Sorry. So again, friction. It's like I paid for the card. You know, I've done all the things I'm supposed to do, and I have a paid airline ticket.
That seems like a bad rule because all the boarding passes say standby when you're standing. So correct. Just look for the standby.
Right. Right. And mine didn't say standby, but he said, nope, the rule is you have to have a seat. You have to have a seat assignment. Like, says my seat's going to be assigned at the gate. Like this oversold flight, I'm not on standby. I'm a ticketed passenger. So there are lots of those things I think that exist today that make it just harder. Yeah. And for what we pay for the premium credit cards,
we had this conversation about, Foz and I did, about what do you do, like what's the consolidation method of these cards and which ones do you get rid of, which ones do you keep? And I think Foz has opinions. I have an opinion.
I can't wait to hear Foz's opinion.
Yeah, what's your opinion, Foz?
I think the only premium card really worth its money is the Venture X.
And why do you think that? Just because it's 2X on everything?
I think, well, it's a reasonable fee at $395.
It is a reasonable fee.
You get $300 back as a travel credit. You get access to the Capital One lounges and Priority Pass lounges.
But no guests.
Okay, no guests, but you don't.
This is different than the reserve.
Yeah.
Well, you can get guests, but you got to spend $75K.
Yeah.
But you also don't have all this coupon book crap.
Yeah.
Do you think they're going to go that way, though? After they've seen their Zerg and...
I'd be surprised if they don't raise the annual fee.
I'd be okay with them raising the annual fee, but not... Like, the problem is the CSR, the Amex button, they've changed leagues by going from 395 cards to 895 for the Amex, right? And 795 for the CSR.
Yeah.
And you're not getting that kind of value out of it, well, especially when you have to wait 40 minutes to get into lounge.
I agree. The thing I think that's the issue is, so we've seen Cap One change the lounge restrictions pretty aggressively in the past 12 months.
Yep.
There's still, I mean, I think, not to timestamp, but there's a big sign-up bonus right now for the Capital One Venture X for Business card. That's going to generate a lot more people that want club access.
But do you think so? Because the spend requirement for that isn't like 150K or something?
But, well, A, I don't think it's that high. But B, I mean, like true business, like I have an Amex Platinum that I put $250,000 to spend on this year. I got the notification. I get the $1,200 airline credit in like 8 months.
And you're like, yay.
Right. But for small business, for the stuff that we can run through a credit card, that's not necessarily hard. And, you know, I do think the addressable user base for Cap One that has lounge access is growing, but their lounge network is not growing anywhere near as much as it has over the past handful of years. So they've built lounges in places where they needed them. Denver's a great example. But I don't think they have another half dozen lounges under construction right now. And they have, let's take Dulles as a great example. It's my home airport. You and I have spent time there. It's 75 or 80 seats.
And it's full.
And it's full all the time. And that's their home market. There's no other premium lounge space at Dulles.
Well, will there be in the new pier?
Yeah. Who do you think has it all?
United.
United's already taken it. They're putting a club there.
Yeah, right, they're taking all of it. And that pier is going to extend it. So will.
Yeah. So maybe over time. But all of the lounge space in the new pier that's opening later this year, early next year is taken. So if Cap One wants to expand, they have to chase out like an Air France or somebody like that from Terminal A, which could happen, to be clear. But that would take years. And so they're going to continue to add credit cards now, but not increase lounge capacity.
Is there anywhere in what's the gates, the international section, like where the Turkish line?
That's AB. And there's no, so you've got Turkish there. British Airways took over the old American Airlines lounge there. Lufthansa has their Senator lounge, which is a two-story lounge. Air France has the old Virgin lounge. Virgin has a lounge. And then Etihad has theirs in Sapphire.
The Sapphire Reserve.
Yeah.
Turkish.
And Turkish, yes. So all
there's no other space there.
There isn't. There are spots in that terminal that could be built on top of. But I don't know that, I don't know that the airport is committed to that. And then the only other space is
in AB, right? There's a lot of seating areas. They could reduce some of the seating areas to,
but with the size of the international planes that come in there.
But I've walked down AB so much waiting for flights that it's never even 80% full. Yes, there's gates.
The gate area, the problem is the gate areas for the size of the planes are severely constrained.
Yeah, but right. But the, very rarely do two gates next to each other.
Agree. They do a good job spacing out the flights for sure.
So you could reduce some of the seating and just broaden the seating area across two gates.
If they were going to do that, I would say it's the southwest gates, right down by where the trains are and in between AB, where the British Airways lounge is. Those last few gates were like Avianca and Southwest, because Southwest is pulling out. So Southwest had the last two gates across from the Lufthansa Senator lounge. That was where they used to fly from. And so you could take that space in theory.
And it's, I would argue that it's probably not that hard to add some space to some parts of AB over there. Like where the escalators are, you could build on top of that.
I definitely think there's places to build on top of it. As I think we all know, the airport authority there is incredibly corrupt and inept. And those two things together.
Every other airport authority?
But look, Newark has managed to build things. As much as we don't mind not like the things they built, they built things.
It took how long?
I understand.
And the train, like, okay, we're taking the train out of service now for 6 years from now?
I know. But look how long it's taken Dulles to get 12 new gates.
That's because they don't want to pay for it.
I agree. So, I mean, somebody's
still rather than fly out of a garage, a glorified garage.
Somebody's really got to want to pony up the bucks to get the airport to build more club space.
Well, I think this goes to something he and I, Steve and I were talking about, is that these, I saw it in DFW, right? These airport authorities are now so focused on publicity. Like, it used to be, if you went back 40 years, it was something in the background. You never knew anything about the airport authority. It just worked. Now, as airport authorities have focused on revenue sharing with all the merchants,
right?
Like, it just, it has become a business like anything else, right? And they are treating it as a business and not a public service.
No, I agree. I do you guys listen to Airlines Confidential at all?
Sometimes.
So they've had the, and I won't remember her name, but they've had the CEO of Pittsburgh International Airport on a couple of times. And I was through there not too long ago. And I mean, I think we all know what Pittsburgh was at one point and then what it became, just this shell of an airport. And I think they've done a pretty commendable job of sort of rebooting that airport in a way that could be sustainable. That, to your point, is almost the antithesis of what the bigger airports are doing right now. And they seem to be doing it in partnership with the airlines in a way that still makes the landing fees reasonable for those airlines.
Right.
I can't think of another airline in the airport in the U.S. that's doing that.
The small ones. Small ones are like this.
Is PDX doing a good job of that?
Yeah, I so. I mean, I think they've got some issues with planning, but I think they're overall like keeping things at street prices, like enforcing that, then keeping landing fees reasonable, I think has been a priority.
Yeah.
Trying to draw carriers and more routes. I think that's kind of, I mean, they were in the same boat as Philly due to, or not Philly, Pittsburgh, because of COVID.
Right.
The numbers still haven't come all the way back.
Yeah.
So I want to switch gears a little bit. You wanted to talk about Spirit and.
Yes, but not Spirit directly, indirectly.
Indirectly, that Spirit.
Yeah. And I never thought that we'd see this day come. So I never put a lot of thought into it. And you guys are like two of the best people I can think of to steel man this argument. But here we sit with the airline that all three of us have flown a lot of miles on over the years.
Yeah.
United does not have a Southeast strategy. And as we said in the car, Washington Dulles is not in the Southeast.
Depends on your definition of Southeast. South of the Mason-Dixon line.
You know, the airline has trouble with the fact that they only have one hub in the Sun Belt. And so from a connectivity standpoint, when Houston goes down, it's really hard to reroute passengers. And reach into the Caribbean is tough because they're originating from points that are so far away from everywhere else. With Spirit falling over and with some potential for a JetBlue/United conglomerate there, I really feel like this is, at least in our lifetime, this is the once in a lifetime opportunity for them to have a real hub in the Southeast that probably won't come again in the time that I'm flying.
But do you do Fort Lauderdale or do you do Tampa where you're not competing with American?
It's a good question. Tampa's certainly better geographically, but I wonder if you could get the sort of gates you need at Tampa to grow.
They keep rebuilding the piers.
Right. And
so Tampa, for those that haven't been, it's like Orlando where it's remote piers. So
yeah,
they're opening one this year, I think, or early next year, one or the other.
I know they're doing an expansion. I think the thing with Fort Lauderdale that appealed to me is, for if crappy as it is, it's quote unquote move-in ready, like the gates are there.
Right. But I think there's more runway capacity and potential for more runway capacity at Tampa.
I agree with you.
Right. There's also maintenance facilities at Tampa.
Oh, okay.
I didn't know that. United has one.
Mm-hmm.
So United already has a hangar there.
Yeah.
Which I think Tampa would be a better fit. The question is, what does it really solve for United? You said Caribbean. So if you're going to the Caribbean, does it really matter if you connect in Tampa versus Houston or Dulles?
Yes, I think so. Because from a segment length standpoint, you're talking about, I think there's a challenge in pulling people from the Southeast to the Caribbean for United because you're backtracking them all to Dulles or Houston.
But how many people from the Southeast? Like, there's so many options nonstop. You've got JetBlue with a bunch of stuff already, right? You have AA in Miami. You have potentially Delta Atlanta.
For sure, but they're not getting, United is not getting their share of the Southeast, in my opinion. Miami and Delta, American and Delta are carving up the Southeast. And the Southeast as a whole, while there certainly are areas that are lower middle income or lower income, there's a lot of money in the Southeast. And United doesn't fly those people.
So let's hype Tampa or Fort Lauderdale either.
Yeah.
Where would you propose they focus the domestic portions other than the other hubs? Like, are you thinking, I mean, they already run San Francisco and LA, Tampa.
Yeah, you're right. They have a couple of Tampa flights. I think that there's been a gap in the Caribbean ever since American pulled out of San Juan. And they do an okay job servicing it from Miami, but there's nowhere near the connectivity to the Caribbean and through the Caribbean that there was when.
You don't think JetBlue's filled most of that?
They don't. And I think JetBlue is more point to point for that sort of stuff. I could be wrong about this. I don't think they're moving a lot of connecting flow.
I think they're moving a fair bit through San Juan. There's not enough O&D in San Juan to go into all these other islands.
Sure, but they're much smaller than American was back in the day. Much, much smaller.
No doubt.
I would say, like, okay, you go from like Memphis south in the southeast. Those customers can fly to Houston or Dulles to go to the Caribbean today. Probably less Dulles, mostly Houston.
Sure.
Or Newark.
Mm-hmm. That's a long backtrack.
It's a long backtrack. A lot of it's overnight because the flights from Newark all leave in the morning.
But I think that's by design, because what I've watched United do with the Caribbean is when there's connecting flow, they will add flights from Houston and Dallas. All the stuff in Newark is supposed to be really there for O&D.
Yeah, sure.
There is enough demand O&D for Newark, the New York area.
But do you really think that the people who live in the Southeast, do you think United can really offer a competitive product by connecting people by backtracking them 90 minutes to 2 hours on that first leg?
I mean, with all of Delta's irregular operations now?
It's fair.
It's working towards United's.
We were talking about that in the car. But I think, like, I also think United's presence, generally speaking, in Central America is not great. I mean, obviously Copa used to be a great partnership for them. It's still a decent partnership. I think there's a good chunk of traffic that flows to Central America that I think both of Delta and American have.
I think United has more lift into Central America than Delta.
I would almost never argue with you on a stat like that. I would just say that I just think that you're there for all the Central America traffic that's in the Southeast. I just don't think
they're making. Well, I think it depends where in Central America you're going. Right, if you're going further west, right, Houston's not a big deal. Right,
for sure.
And
I would say it's not necessarily a big deal. People will get by with it, but the connections are. So my business partner has been spending some time in Panama, and so he's doing some of the connecting in Houston. I've looked at these itineraries; they're horrible.
Yeah, I guess. But if you're sitting in the Southeast, if you have to pick your poison between Atlanta, Miami, or Houston, I would pick Houston over the other two any day.
But if you look at these itineraries, a lot of these are you're flying into Houston late at night, and then you're taking some fucked 3.5-hour red eye to someplace in Central America like Panama. It's not what anybody would call desirable flying.
I think you could just solve all this if Kirby gets his wish and they merge with American.
Who let him in here?
That's Miami right there, baby.
Oh, God. No, we don't want Miami.
No, you don't. I've always felt like there was just way too big a gap. Dulles is too far north and Houston is too far west for an airline that, you know, for a major airline to have coverage in the U.S.
The other thing to think about is if there are irregular operations in Houston and you're trying to get people from the Southeast, you're limited. Like, some of that stuff isn't served by anywhere except Houston and Dallas, maybe Chicago.
Yeah. I mean, but when you look at United's hub strategy, right, it's all in business centers. So what is the business center in Florida?
Probably more. I guess there's different business centers for Tampa than there is for Fort Lauderdale. I think, you know, you've seen a lot of like the movies, have moved to Florida. So there's a lot of traffic between South Florida and Southern California. So that there's a market there. There's more of a business market for manufacturing production stuff, I would say, in the Tampa area.
Maybe you're playing Pokemon Go.
I got a notification about Pokemon Go on my watch. I'm not playing. Probably should turn notifications off while I watch. Somewhere Richard is laughing at how many notifications I get. He always laughs about that. So in terms of, to your point, in terms of one of them being a major, like, there's no city in the Southeast that has a big enough business center for United to use the same hub strategy that they use in like a Chicago or a Denver. That's for sure. But I do think, you know, I don't think you know, a Memphis or a Nashville is ever going to be a robust hub, but they could support, like, I mean, like, American has tried to make a go of things like Nashville, Southwest, but sort of made a go of Nashville. I think that that's all fine, but to me, those cities to me are probably not big enough from an O&D standpoint to support a major hub. And that's where I say, like, leaning a little bit further south, you obviously pick up some level of connecting flow to places people want to go, and you pick up a reasonable amount of O&D for people that want to go to sunshine places on the coast.
I would argue Fort Lauderdale, because you pick up some of the Miami traffic.
People. You do. I think he brings up a good point about runway constraints. It's a very valid point. I think I lean towards South Florida as well. But ATC and runway constraints is an issue. The other reason why, though, I liked South Florida is I feel like, and I could be wrong, this is very notional, I feel like with weather patterns, while there are storms in South Florida, the storms are more severe and sustained in Central Florida than they are in South Florida.
Hmm. I mean, what side of the peninsula is better from a weather standpoint, east or west?
Tampa, I mean, you have to look through this. I mean, Tampa's probably a little bit further north than I want to be for some of the more severe storms. I certainly wouldn't want to make Orlando a hub. It's like LA. I don't know that you could ever get enough gates to truly be a hub there.
Would you get enough of Tampa?
I don't know. Like, Foz brings up a good point about the fact that they're adding a pier there. They have a lot of land.
They have six piers, right? They have spots for six piers. I think at any time, four are open.
And the airport is built in such a way, with the way those remote piers are built, that it's easy to get
more.
Yeah. And it's also easy to get people back. Like, if you need to extend the piers, if you want to add 8 or 10 gates to the end, mm-hmm. the transit system between the piers is fine.
The only thing that would suck at Tampa that they need to figure out is security. Because right now, all the piers are isolated.
Yes.
Oh, so it's a line at each pier.
Correct. You clear into your pier.
The security's at the far side, unlike Orlando.
Yeah, it's in a central, yeah.
Where yeah. It's at the in the main building.
Yeah, and it would be tough there. So, I mean, I don't remember the pier numbers in Tampa, but there's constraints around some of the pier entrances that would make it tough to build it. And look, the security facilities out at some of those piers are overwhelmed at times, just like how many people come out and like you come up by the escalator, and there's like an area where everybody stands and queues, and it sort of like shrinks to a diagonal. And those are not big enough now today that you'd need to add some more gates. But you'd have to move some pretty big walls in the main parts of the Tampa terminal to get security in that main hall.
Hmm. Maybe. I mean, but maybe not. Remember, they did some extensions to that building for the monorail. So they can do some build outs.
Yeah, you could put it outside by the monorail, yeah. Like I've always thought that they should consider doing some of that at an airport like a Chicago, where you just push stuff out over the ring road and have people clear security further away. Or like LA, where they're building the transit facility further away, like have people clear security before they get on the train and then drop them in a terminal.
They could get rid of the train and just build something over the airport road that connects all three on each side.
Yeah.
And they could actually do a U, so in theory, you could go all the way around, like Minneapolis.
Yeah. Yeah, no, I definitely think there are things you could do there. And you know, Tampa does have plenty of land. I don't know.
Isn't Tampa like the largest, like, land by, or largest airport by land ownership?
Maybe east of Mississippi, because Denver.
I think it's bigger than Denver.
And DFW.
I think it's bigger than.
Wow. Look it up.
I had this discussion with someone. Yeah.
The only thing I'm not sure with Tampa is obviously you have I don't know how much of it is developable without significant expense because of the water table.
Yeah. But, I mean, you don't need to build for 20, 30 years out. You could stay within the current footprint, expand that.
Denver, 33,000 acres. DFW, 17,000 acres. Southwest Florida International, Fort Myers, 13,000 and a half acres.
Half of it's swamps.
Might be more than half.
So I was wrong. I knew there was one in Florida, but that's.
But I think Fort Myers has. I mean, they have a couple of places that they get flights in from over in Europe. So I think they have a nice long runway there.
Yeah, because
like Eurowings or somebody flies in there. I don't know. It's an interesting time in the airline industry. You know, we haven't seen an airline the size of Spirit fail in quite some time, and so I just thought it was an interesting time to think about the map, and you guys, more so than almost everybody I know, are, savants when it comes to thinking through these things. Like, I had this whole brainchild about Fort Lauderdale, and you shot a hole in it in 30 seconds talking about Tampa. I mean, so it's a very viable alternative. But I think let's close this with a question, because we've talked through all these different things, and I think I know your answer. Set aside Fort Lauderdale versus Tampa, do you think it's the right decision for United to try to pursue a Southeast hub?
In the long term, yes, but not when fuel is $4 a gallon.
That's fair. Right. Do you know when fuel is going to go down below $4 a gallon?
If I knew that, I'd be playing the market, not sitting here talking with the two of you.
He knew that, he wouldn't be here.
Yeah, yeah, that's fair. Well, I'd like to think you'd be here, but we'd be at the Wynn.
Well, yeah.
We have beautiful resorts.
Yeah. We'd have private jets waiting. We wouldn't be waiting on United.
We wouldn't know where the priority path lounge is.
I think Kirby thinks about these things,
but I don't think they're comfortable with that yet. I don't think they're like in a spot where they could say, let's build another hub. I think they're comfortable in adding new routes.
Yeah.
They're not comfortable in let's go wholesale on.
Well, I mean, look, all we have to do is look at Seattle, right? And look at how much Delta is struggling by, like, that's the newest hub.
Yeah.
Out there for a major,
and they're burning money.
And they are burning money. Now, the advantage to Tampa would be there's no big incumbent.
I was going to say, I think Delta overestimated or underestimated Alaska's ability to compete there.
It's less Alaska's ability to compete, but Alaska's following.
Yeah.
The loyalty to Alaska.
They thought they could just flip people over.
Yeah. Right. And I think, you know, the places that we're talking about, Fort Lauderdale and Tampa, well, I mean, Tampa's obviously not an open slate for others. United happens to have a big presence there. But I think, you know, Fort Lauderdale right now is an open spot on the map. It's big enough to be a hub, and nobody has control of it.
I mean, JetBlue, beyond Spirit, JetBlue would be the second largest carrier of Fort Lauderdale.
I agree, and that's what I say. I thought, like, part of this strategy for United could be that JetBlue is effectively a proxy at this point. And they're like, they could have an implicit strategy where JetBlue and United are going to both grow there on different routes with the intent that they're going to combine at some point and turn into a hub later.
Yeah, look, that's the reality, right? Like, right now, if you look at it from United's perspectives, JetBlue's days are numbered, and they're letting them do the dirty work, the hard work of building a hub there.
Could be, and but to be clear, I think for what JetBlue has announced so far, I don't think it's gone nearly far enough to be called a hub.
But they have a lot of stuff there already,
to some degree. But I think, I mean, like the frequency on the routes that they're adding is not what I would call hub quality. It's squatting on some gates with, you know, like a mishmash of stuff. You need to start connecting real cities to Fort Lauderdale, and like the Detroit's probably the only few on that list. I looked at it, was like, all right, well, that's a city where they can move traffic, somewhat how Spirit used to.
I mean, the thing with JetBlue is they don't have enough small planes.
I agree.
And that's their gating factor for Lauderdale.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. But I mean, you know, if you're really going to execute a Fort Lauderdale strategy, I think you're going to roll out more Memphis, more Nashville, more Cincinnati, more Chicago, more Indianapolis. You're going to tackle 10 to 15 Midwest cities. One or two of them are probably going to be big, but most of them are going to be medium. Like, take a city like Indianapolis. You could, you know, the population are in and around Indianapolis could absolutely support a couple more flights to South Florida. That,
yeah.
You know, that's not a hard bridge to overcome. That to me is like, I don't discount what JetBlue has rolled out, but it doesn't strike me as somebody who's building a hub. Some of the routes are desirable, but they're not bringing people from the places where people are.
JetBlue is also not in a position to go full bore right now financially.
I agree.
And so 100%. I think they're testing the waters.
Mm-hmm.
I think they're trying to do as much as they can with as little as they can.
I agree. But that's what I say. Like, somebody could step in. United could say, we're going to run. And I don't know if they have the fleet for this. Again, you guys would know well better than I do. But, like, you know, run. You're going to do twice daily from 8 Midwest cities into Fort Lauderdale.
I think it's doable.
It's possible.
Yeah. They have the planes to do it.
But do they have enough regional jets to do it?
E-175s, baby.
Do they have enough? The 475 fleet is pretty busy.
Soon you'll have CRJ-200s with first class.
They already do. Oh, the 200s. So.
The 200s.
The new 450, I think is what they're going to call it. Yeah.
You put those babies on Fort Lauderdale routes.
And
for might actually be right size.
Suddenly backtracking a dollar doesn't seem so bad.
Well, and I'd have to look at the numbers, but my guess would be, I don't know that there's 10 or 15, but my guess is we could get to four or five cities in the Midwest right now where you could do narrow bodies. Memphis, Nashville, Indianapolis, maybe a Kansas City. I'd have to look at the cities to make sure, because I haven't put the thought into this. But there's, I'm not saying you could do six a day, but I think you could have a couple of regional frequencies a day and a couple of narrow bodies a day and have a schedule.
Yeah, you could.
And you could take a, I mean, United doesn't have a lot of 319s, but you could feed something like a 320 and you could go, you know, Nashville, Fort Lauderdale, Dulles, and then wherever 320s go after they leave Dulles. So
they had more 319s than sick.
So they're getting rid of them, though.
Yeah. I thought they were paring that fleet down, though. Yeah. Yeah. Well, yeah.
That's the thing. United doesn't have many 120-seat planes, right? They've got 60-something 319s, I think, and 20-something 73Gs.
And the problem I see with the 319 specifically into Southern Florida is I think the strategy there, look, don't get me wrong. There's a strategy there for a low-cost carrier, Allegiant, whoever, like Sunshine, like we know that capacity. If there's a strategy for United, in my opinion, it's by flying the premium seats down there from places. Like there's plenty of money in Indianapolis and Nashville and Memphis and places like that. The 319 has what?
12?
Right. It's a very small cabin.
But I mean, 12 might be enough for now.
You have a bunch of Spirit 320s.
BFS, baby, big red seat. But those only have two rows of BFS.
But those would be easy to equip.
We could add them. And for the record, I just want to say that I took a picture. I know we're an audio podcast, but I took a picture just out of a moment of silence. Resorts World has both the small buzz balls and the big buzz balls. So in honor of Spirit, I took that picture the other day.
Anything else you guys want to chat about?
No, I'm good.
I just want to say that just because we're not time stamping this definitely did not happen right after May 4th.
No, not at all.
I also threw Ed off because I showed up instead of Foz the first day.
That was really funny. Yeah, from my perspective, Foz and I have been talking about getting together. I had forgotten that you guys were doing a run. I thought that was last weekend, but that shows how messed up my life is. And I completely forgot that Steven was with you. And so when you were coming to Vegas, my schedule got changed around, and then all of a sudden you're like, well, I'll come earlier and we'll have dinner. And you're very diligently texting me back every time we're talking about where to have dinner and the whole bit. And you suggested Thai food, which was, apparently Steven suggesting Thai food. And I came around the corner at Wynn because we went to Mizumi for teppanyaki. And the first thing that went through my head was, why the hell did Foz bring Steven and not tell me? Are they really going to have a third seat or not? It didn't even occur to me that I was getting played.
He just kind of looked at me. And I think he was looking for you next.
Yes, I was. Yeah, yeah. And I think I made some very bad joke about maybe ice grabbed you at the airport or something like that.
Oh, I didn't hear that one.
No, you are there for that.
Oh, man. Well, thanks, Ed, for coming on the show. We appreciate it.
Thank you.
This is probably the only time I will ever be in this lounge.
Never coming back?
Okay, list all the reasons why you would come here.
I wouldn't.
Yeah, okay.
I would have set this hurdle.
Good to see you guys.
Good to see you. Talk to you soon. Take care.